which is United States versus, and I might need a little bit of help with the pronunciation, is it Elise or Elise? Elise, okay, as in Champs-Élysées, very good. And so Mr. Adler will lead us off.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Andrew Adler from the Federal Defender's Office. With me at counsel table is trial counsel Ian McDonald. 2 weeks after the incident giving rise to this felon in possession case, a man named Darius Dean walked into the Homestead Police Department and confessed that he was the passenger who possessed the firearm on the night in question. At trial, the defense sought to elicit that confession not to prove that it was true, but rather to prove that the officer who heard it, Raul Cabrera, failed to investigate Dean as a suspect. Because that confession was offered not for its truth, but rather for the effect that it had on the investigating officer's state of mind, that District Court erroneously excluded it as hearsay, and that error significantly impaired the defense in this case. At trial, the defense was that the officers pinned the firearm on Elise not because he actually had it, but because he was the only occupant of the vehicle that they caught that night.
Can I ask you just maybe the most basic hearsay question imaginable? When you say that something is introduced for a purpose other than the truth of the matter asserted, or to prove something other than the proof to the truth of the matter asserted, how are we deciding what purpose or effect the evidence has? How do we decide whether something is for X or for Y? Is it your intent, effect on the hearer? Which is it?
Your Honor, I'm not sure how to answer that in the abstract, but in this case, the defense counsel, the government, and the court all understand that our purpose in offering this confession was for the effect that it had on the investigating officer's state of mind. Everybody understood that that was our theory of admissibility. So this isn't a case where there was, you know, ambiguity about why we were trying to get this in. Everyone understood it was to show that Cabrera, 2 weeks after the incident, is ignoring a suspect who comes in off the street and says, I was the one who got away, I was the one with the firearm that evening. And that would have validated our defense at this trial because it would have shown that the officers were more concerned about making a case than they were with what actually happened. And this trial, of course, was already a very close trial. We know that from the jury question that was submitted, from the length of the deliberations in this case. And so we don't see how the significance of that evidence that was excluded, coupled with the closeness of this trial. Yes?
I'm concerned with whether this whole matter was properly preserved for appellate review.
Your Honor, the government has never...
Let me explain.
Sure.
As I understand it, the issue for... In the opening statement, did you try the case?
No, Your Honor. Counsel did. Co-counsel did.
In the opening statement, he described for the jury what Dean's confession, as it were.
Okay. Yes.
The first time on the record, as far as I could see, that this issue surfaced was during the government's case in chief, in which defense counsel announced but when Cabrera was going to testify, a couple of witnesses down, they wanted to ask him about the confession. And there was some dialogue that went, the district court put it off, and then two or three stages later, ultimately overruled your proffer, as it were. But there was no proffer. All it was prosecutors, your counsel's representation as to what would be said to Cabrera, but very succinctly.
Your Honor.
The surrounding circumstances. And the prosecutor in response, all that he just said, he never would have investigated because he didn't believe, et cetera, Dean's statement. But that's not an evidentiary proffer as far as I'm concerned. Counsel should have, when Cabrera got on the witness stand, asked the court, in the absence of the jury, he wanted to voir dire him on this cross-examination. And then you could have had the government respond in voir dire, also in the absence of the jury. We'd have a complete picture of the point. Do you follow me?
Yes, Your Honor, I have several responses to that. The first is that the government has never made this argument on appeal. The second argument is that everybody understood what the I believe there was a proffer by the defense. Everyone understood what Officer Cabrera was going to be testifying to.
But if we had to write an opinion in this case and describe the proffer, we'd be taking it from nothing in the record as far as I'm concerned.
Your Honor, we repeatedly explained what, and the court understood what was going to be said by Officer Cabrera. And we
all of the facts about the circumstance, especially when the government's position is that the way in which Dean presented himself and what he said and some other things explained the reaction. None of that's in the record. That's a conclusion.
Correct.
But no evidence.
Correct. There's no evidence because the judge ruled that it was hearsay and it cannot come in. So by the time Officer Cabrera testified, the judge had already ruled that it's not coming in. And we believe that under Rule 103A2 of the Federal Rules of Evidence, that an exclusion of evidence is properly preserved, whereas here
I agree we can rule on the narrow question of whether it's hearsay. But as far as Rule 403 and everything else is concerned, we don't have a record.
That's correct, but that's exactly why this should have been presented to the jury. The jury could, if we had been allowed to ask Cabrera about the confession and what he did, the government could
You wanted to just put the confession in and at the end of
it. No, Your Honor, we wanted to ask Cabrera about what he did in response.
I understand that. You're going to have Cabrera recite what Dean said.
And what he did in response as a matter of...
But there's no proffers to that.
Your Honor, there's no...
Nothing in the record in which we could put it in an opinion as to exactly what the atmosphere, the circumstances were in the Homestead Police Station.
Your Honor, I agree with...
When Dean came. Nothing.
Your Honor, I agree with that, but I believe that the district judge was aware, and when she ruled that this was hearsay, what the general circumstances were. And her position was that this is not an effect on the listener because Officer Cabrera did not do anything in response to the confession. So we think that's a legal ruling, a legal reasoning that undergirded her exclusion of this evidence. We think this court can rule on that. So I understand Your Honor's concern that maybe there could have been a bigger picture.
A classical way of handling this matter, will you agree, would have been to interrogate Cabrera in camera in the absence of the jury when he took the witness stand.
That would have been a more preferable way.
We would have had a complete record.
Sure.
Because then the prosecutor would have developed all of the circumstances, still in the absence of the jury, as to why he did nothing.
Yes, and we offered to do that. We offered to make a proffer, and the court said, "I don't want to hear of a proffer. I would be willing to."
I can't find that in the record,
Your Honor.
Can't find anything in the record.
There was a moment where the judge. Sorry.
In which, when Cabrera got on the witness stand, you asked for the jury to be excused while you could question him.
No. I'm saying there was a time where we offered to put on a proffer, and the court said, no, I don't want to hear a proffer.
But where is that in the record?
I don't have the page number, but the court then said, I don't want to hear a proffer.
Where in the record is it?
Your Honor, I don't have
I read the record, and I couldn't find it.
Your Honor, I can get the page number for you on rebuttal. I don't have it in front of me at the moment. But we think that, as you acknowledge, that this is, you know, we all understood what the theory was and what the general contours were of his testimony. And by the time Cabrera took the stand and testified, the ruling was already in place. So maybe we could have done it better, but we think it was properly preserved in this case. And we think it really made a difference.
And it may have been, had there been a full proffer, that your theory would have fallen. Forget the hearsay. Collapsed. Because the court would have seen everything that happened there in that police station.
But even if that was true and the government said, and the officer said, look, there was a good reason why we didn't investigate this confession and we let him go, we believe that was a matter for the jury to consider. That goes to the weight of the evidence for the jury to consider, not whether it's hearsay. It doesn't change the fact that we were offering this to prove not that it was true, but to show that he didn't investigate him. And yeah, maybe the government could come back and ask Cabrera, well, why didn't you investigate this man? And Cabrera could say, well, X, Y, and Z reasons.
Of course he would ask that. In a voir dire proffer, that would have occurred.
Right, but that wouldn't affect the admissibility. That would.
We don't know whether it would or not, because assuming it wasn't hearsay, the court could have kept it out under 403.
There's never
because
been...
Because the probative value was minuscule.
Your Honor, we disagree with that. There's never been that concern that's been raised by anyone in this case. There's no question that this was highly relevant to the defense. And if there was any concern about it being prejudicial, there could have been a limiting instruction saying, look, jury, you cannot consider this for the truth. It's only being offered for the effect on the listener. And so that's why there was no Rule 403 concern that was raised in that regard. And that's why a limiting instruction could have cured any problem here. But I do think it was highly probative because it would have validated our defense, which is that the officers cared more about making a case than what actually happened in this case. And that would have cast significant doubt on whether Mr. Elize was in fact guilty when the officers are ignoring another suspect who comes in off the street and gives an unsolicited confession. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Dion.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Scott Dion for the United States. With me at council table is Assistant United States Attorney Nicole Mariani. The first thing I'd like to address is that the defense or appellant mischaracterizes the record. The court offered to have a proffer, and defense declined that offer. So that's the first thing. And with respect to the fact that the government didn't raise
a proffer in terms of interrogating Cabrera in the absence of the jury?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. I couldn't find that.
Yeah, can you point us to record references? I know he said he would find us someone in rebuttal. I think I find is where the court initially says, I'll be happy to hear the testimony outside the presence of the jury, but then the discussion just sort of devolves.
Right, Your Honor, and the government would read that as defense not opting to take that.
But you said they rejected her offer. Did they say no thanks? Or did we just sort of never circle back as a group to it?
I think implicitly they said no thanks. They didn't take her up on her offer. And to the extent that, assuming for these purposes that was a non-hearsay statement, this court can take up invited error, and I think just as Judge Choflat observed, this was an invited error. The appellants had their opportunity to at least do an in-camera interrogation of the officer and opted not to do so. And to that end, the court actually offered to have a statement, not exactly the statement that the defense wanted, but a statement regarding a confession to be admitted as evidence, along with other packaged relevant evidence. And again, appellant's counsel at trial opted not to take that offer. And as this court observed, like all evidence, it's subject to Rule 403. The court, at least implicitly, again, realized that the prejudicial value of this confession on its face far outweighed its probative value.
But you never really made the prejudice argument, right? I mean, I would have thought, you know, your argument all along was that this just is hearsay, that forget about, and in fact, I think in your briefs to us, you're saying, forget about what they say they're saying. What they really mean is that they wanted this in for the truth.
Right, and to the extent, to the extent that the government's brief draws a bright line between action and inaction, upon further review, we think that proposition might have stepped too far. And I think there is, and it may well be true, that this confession serves some non-hearsay purpose. But like all evidence, it's subject to Rule 403. The court acted within its discretion in limiting the potential for this statement to be misinterpreted for its truth by the jury, and instead offered the defense an opportunity to have the offer to confess admitted as evidence.
Is that really the basis, though, on which the court excluded the evidence? I mean, did the court ever say, as my friend Stan Marcus would say, in words or substance, that, you know, we're excluding it on a 403 basis?
No, I think initially the court sort of matter-of-factly said that I think it's being offered for its truth. And at the time, as Judge Choflat observed, there was no proffer to show how this became relevant. And you know, sort of in a vacuum, that statement could only be read for its truth. It was a confession. And without the attached, you know, proffer of, we're going to question the officer this way, we're going to say this, It never became relevant for that other purpose to show effect on the listener.
Then how do you suspect? You said a moment ago that it was the judge implicitly balanced and rejected the evidence. From what you just described, I don't see the implication.
Well, I think if you read the entire record together, the exposition began in the morning of day two of trial, and it ended in the afternoon of day two of trial. There were sort of two stages to this. At first, the court matter-of-factly says, I think it's being offered for its truth. The court later realizes it may be relevant if the government introduces these jail calls, which show that there was a doctored confession. At that time, the court says, I'll admit some form of the statement, but not the statement itself. And in that, I think there was an implicit Rule 403 balancing saying, the statement itself, you can't divorce what it says from reality. The reality is it's a confession. It says, I was the passenger. To show effect on the listener, it has the same, that statement is no different than saying, Darius Dean came in and offered to confess. And I think the court, of course, the record is not the clearest on this matter, but I think the court, again, implicitly made this 403 balancing.
I keep wondering if this whole effect on the listener thing is sort of a sideshow. I mean, if in order for something to be admissible, it doesn't, over and against a hearsay objection, it doesn't have to be sort of admitted for some specific purpose. It just has to be admitted for some purpose other than the truth of the matter asserted. So, I mean, couldn't the non-hearsay purpose here, whether it's effect on the listener or otherwise, I mean, couldn't it be just simply the knowledge that the cops had that this person had walked in and confessed? I mean, who cares, I guess, really, if it had any effect on them or not? Both sides here are talking about the effect on the listener. But why should we be concerned about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, it may well be true that there was some non-hearsay purpose. And I think even assuming that, there's other ways that the court either offered to have this admitted or that appellant invited an error by not, in allowing the court to hear more on this matter. So
have you your opponent said in opening that you haven't raised any sort of waiver/abandonment/invited error argument. Is it possible that you've waived the waiver?
To the extent that the government didn't raise waiver, I think that's this court's precedent is against us, but this court can sua sponte take up invited error. And I think in this case there was invited error.
It just sounds like your position has pretty radically changed from the one that you took in the briefs. In the briefs, it was very gung-ho, this was hearsay, no doubt about it. And now you're telling us, I mean, the first words out of your mouth were, even if this wasn't hearsay, I think we might have overstepped, but it was invited error. Yes, we might have waived the waiver, but you can sua sponte to invited error. It just seems like things have pretty radically changed.
Your Honor, I think that's a correct observation. I think, our argument definitely has changed upon further review. I don't think that makes our arguments wrong, and I don't think that our lack of argument, under this broad abuse of discretion standard, I don't think our lack of a specific argument on this, on these grounds, waives our opportunity to raise it at oral argument.
Yeah, I'm not faulting you. It wasn't that long ago that I was a lawyer, and almost every time I had an oral argument, I felt like I reconceptualized the case walking into the argument. It was always very frustrating to me that I hadn't, mooted the case before I briefed it. I just wanted to make sure I had my head sort of hands around where your current position.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, I think there's definitely arguments to be made that this was a non-hearsay, this served a non-hearsay purpose. But to that end, I think the confession itself on its face was never coming in just because of the Rule 403 implications.
Does the record tell us, or do you know, whether Dean had a record, criminal record?
I do not know, Your Honor.
We don't know whether Cabrera looked it up or not, do we?
No, Your Honor.
The point I'm making is somebody walks into the police station and he confesses to a crime, what would you expect the officer to do?
And, Your Honor,
arrest him on the spot.
That's an inference that could have been drawn by the jury.
Well, we don't know of any of those things, but that means that's the first thing that came to my mind.
Right, and again, to that end,
into the police station,
defense had every opportunity.
Confesses to a basically to a crime.
Right, and defense had every opportunity to call Darius Dean as a witness.
The first thing was look up under the NCIC and find out what offenses this guy has committed.
Of course, and to the extent that's not on the record, this could have been cleared up if...
That's a whole scenario.
If Darius Dean was called as a witness. And I think defense had every opportunity to call him as a witness, and they opted not to.
Mr. Dean, in your brief, you devoted all of one sentence at the end of this argument to invoke harmless error. You stand by that?
Yeah, I think...
It's so cursory in the brief. It's really a conclusion. You didn't really advert to any reasoning.
Right, and again... Upon further review of this brief, I think there's more to be said about harmless error as well. To the extent that this impeachment evidence could have been admitted as non-hearsay, it was just a single piece of impeachment evidence in a case where, as appellant himself put in his brief, the defense exposed numerous inconsistencies and even flat-out lies. So just this small piece of evidence taken alone does not overcome that harmless error standard. The defense was not actually prejudiced by this, and that's actually shown by the course of the proceedings. Defense had an opportunity to get this statement admitted in a different form, but with the same effect to show that someone came in and confessed, and they opted not to because of the attached baggage, and that was the jail calls that showed that this was clearly a doctored confession that appellant had called his friend. We don't know if it was Darius Dean, but called his friend indicating that he was going to have someone else come in and falsely confess to the crime. So on both of those ends, I think, whether it's harmless error, invited error, there's a number of ways that this, even if there were an error.
That aspect of the jail call come into the record?
So all of the jail calls that the government wished to be admitted were played for the court, and the government proffered on the record some parts of the jail calls, explanations of some parts of the jail calls. But the record, because these weren't...
Had this come in as defense counsel wished it had, you would have then, I presume, had reference to the jail call about a doctor inducing a confession.
Right. Had this come in as defense wished...
That seems to me more relevant to the harmless error claim than perhaps anything else.
Right, Your Honor. Had this... And that's sort of my point. Had this come in, the record, albeit not entirely clearly, shows that these calls would have at least called into question, if not totally... found it bogus, if not totally, allowed the jury to come to a conclusion that this was a bogus confession.
What about from a harmlessness perspective, the fact that the jury asked this question about sort of constructive possession? It seemed like they might have been doubtful about whether or not Mr. Elize was in fact the passenger.
Well, to the extent that they had some doubt, and this is just an inference that we can draw from one jury question, to the extent that they had doubt, they ultimately reached a verdict. And I think the evidence here was entirely
Well, but they,
clear.
I guess that's sort of my point. They reached a verdict without the benefit of the evidence that was excluded, right? Without the benefit of the confession of someone else, they had, the question at least suggests that they had some doubt in their minds about whether or not Elize was the driver of the passenger. The only evidence you had was, you didn't have any physical evidence. You just had eyewitness testimony. Their theory was that you'd been pinning it on Elize from the beginning because that's the only guy you caught. And so without the benefit of the hearsay evidence that they think might have tipped the jury in the other direction, how can we say harmless?
And I think when you look at the record as a whole, this hearsay statement was never coming in by itself. And I think the court made that clear in packaging this sort of all or nothing offer. and defense or appellant's trial counsel strategically chose not to have this confession admitted because of the optics of those jail calls. So to the extent that this might have tipped the scale, I think defense had every opportunity to try to tip that scale, and they chose not to at the time, strategically deciding that these jail calls and the implications of the jail calls and the inferences that could be drawn from the jail calls did not favor defense. If the court has no further questions, we'll rest on our briefs.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Adler, you've got 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, the government has just conceded that there was an error in this case, so I think we have to say, is there another way we can affirm this conviction? Judge Newsom, you're correct. There's no way this can possibly be considered harmless given the jury question. Yes.
If it's true that the district judge asked defense counsel for a proffer and defense counsel declined, then the court would have been within its rights in terms of ruling on evidentiary proposition simply to deny the request to put in the evidence, whatever that was, the cross-examination in the future.
Your Honor, we never...
So what the district judge did, it in effect said, no, there's no proffer here, and then it went on and entertained the lawyer's arguments out of lawyer talk, basically. You agree? Lawyer representation.
Your Honor, that was the basis of the ruling.
I understand. The court first said, I want to have a proffer, and it's declined. So now...
Your Honor, I disagree. On page 292, I looked it up for you. 292, he said, to the extent our defense counsel said, to the extent that a proffer would be helpful, and the judge cut him off. And the judge said, well, I don't think so. I'd rather hear from the lawyer, from the witness out of the presence of the jury. Then after that, the judge ruled, excluded it as hearsay.
Let me ask you this. The fact that the government's brief does not argue that the court did not abuse its discretion because there was no proffer at all, and all you had was lawyer talk, that the fact that they didn't raise that point, does that help you?
I think it shows that there was clearly a preserved error here, and that's why they're not arguing it.
But what we tell the district courts in an opinion is, beware on how you handle these evidentiary matters, because the government's brief on appeal may be sloppy in the sense that doesn't raise the point.
No, Your Honor, I think you just look to Rule 103A2 of the Rules of Evidence that governs the exclusion of evidence, and it says that to preserve a claim of error for the exclusion of evidence, there has to be a proffer or not if the substance of the evidence is clear from the context.
It's accepted by the court in full.
The rule does not say that, Your Honor.
That's implicit in it. Otherwise, you just have lawyers standing in the well of the court making arguments.
That, Your Honor, that these proffers happen all the time without actual evidence.
You may do that down in this district, but not elsewhere in the circuit, I'll tell you that.
Your Honor, I understand your concern, and perhaps we could have done it better, but I do think it was preserved in this case for this court's review. And the government has conceded that there is an error, and there's no way that it can be harmless, given not just the jury question, but the length of deliberations. The jury deliberated in this case for 3 hours and 24 minutes in a trial that they were in court for 5 hours and 18 minutes, excluding jury selection. That is a long period of deliberation for such a short and straightforward gun trial. And all we're asking for here is a new trial where the jury gets to learn about this significant information that came to light. The lead investigator, Raul Cabrera, was the federal task force officer in this case. He was the case agent. And an individual is coming in 2 weeks later and confessing to this crime. And he's saying, thanks, not interested. We've already got our guy. And I think that would have been particularly compelling for the jury to learn about that information. And the government gets to come back and rehabilitate him and say, well, why did you ignore him? But that all goes to the weight of the confession, the weight of the of the evidence, not admissibility. It doesn't change the fact that we're not offering this for the truth. This court has repeatedly recognized that out-of-court statements made to law enforcement officers are not hearsay, where they're offered to explain the course of the investigation. The Baker case, footnote 17, Jimenez, Ransford, these are published decisions where this court has repeatedly recognized that. As the government has just conceded, conceded there's no basis to carve out this scenario from those line of cases. I don't think, if you're concerned, Your Honor, about writing an opinion, I don't think this court can write an opinion saying this is not hearsay just because the officer did not investigate the suspect. And that was the basis, Your Honor, on page 310 of the transcript is where we get the final ruling. And the court says, I've looked at these cases, these affect on the listener cases. I don't think that they apply because there was no affirmative action on the part of the officer. There's no legal basis to uphold that error. It's not harmless. This newfound assertion of invited error that I've just heard about for the first time is borderline frivolous, Your Honor. We were trying to get this in from the opening statement throughout. I mean, we previewed this in our opening for the jury, and we said, you're not just going to hear about the confession. You're going to hear about what the officer who heard it did in response. That's on 152 to 153. So our theory of admissibility is clear throughout on pages 260 and 279 of the transcript. The government and the court understand exactly what's going on here. They're not disputing that this happened, that there was a confession, and that there was no response. The court understands it. We confirm that's exactly what our theory is. And so we just don't see any way that this cannot be sent back for a new trial. That's all we're asking, is for a new trial free from significant evidentiary errors that prejudice the defense. We don't think that's too much to ask for, given that before we send Mr. Elize to prison for 19 and a half years. Thank you very much.
All right, that case is submitted. We'll give